you know, someone's sexuality does not define their essence. I will pass any test that the Florida state has for me on my ability to parent.
I think it's just unusual for a show to really kind of confront mortality and spirituality in sort of just a practical way, which is one of the reasons I was drawn to the project, just the notion of people who we pay to face death for us, what that must do to their lives.
Welcome to This Way Out, the international lesbian and gay radio magazine. I'm Greg Gordon. A senator's parliamentary slander against a gay high court judge rocks Australia, Rosie's broadcast outing boosts Florida's adoption rights battle, and the gay gallows humor of Oscar winner Alan Ball is buried 6 feet under. All that and more this week, now that you've discovered This Way Out.
I'm Christopher Gall.
And I'm Cindy Friedman.
With News Wrap, a summary of some of the news in or affecting the lesbian and gay community for the week ending March 16, 2002. Australia was rocked this week when the Prime Minister's parliamentary secretary launched a verbal attack on openly gay High Court Justice Michael Kirby on the Senate floor. Liberal Party Senator from New South Wales, Bill Heffernan, was calling for the establishment of a royal commission to investigate child sexual abuse, a topic that many call an obsession for him. But taking off from Kirby's role in a decision to grant a high court appeal to a Roman Catholic priest sentenced to more than 10 years imprisonment for molesting altar boys, Heffernan declared Kirby unfit to sit on such cases. Referring to materials from NSW's notorious Wood Royal Commission of several years ago, which was established to investigate police corruption but focused at length on age of consent violations between males, Heffernan alleged that Kirby had regularly trawled for rough trade at the Darlinghurst Wall in Sydney, paid young men for sex, and used his government vehicle in the process. Heffernan claimed he had new evidence which he was sending on to police, but did not enter it into the parliamentary record.
Few have given credence to Heffernan's remarks, which are protected from any lawsuit by parliamentary privilege. Both the Wood Royal Commission and the NSW police had previously found allegations against an unnamed judge, presumed to be Kirby, to be unfounded and unsubstantiated, or as a witness described them, bitchy gossip. For example, on an occasion in which Kirby's car was thought to have been spotted, Kirby himself was many miles away in Canberra. One of the sex workers believed to be a key witness for Heffernan was discredited by the court in the lawsuit that ultimately cleared openly gay attorney John Marsden of allegations he'd paid for sex with underage teens. NSW police are expected to decide in the coming week whether to investigate Kirby further after they receive the documents Heffernan mailed to them. But that's not likely to happen. The Sunday Age newspaper reports those consisted of a 1994 driver's record and a 100-word declaration from a former sex worker, neither of which actually alleges illegal conduct by Kirby.
Kirby responded with a brief media release saying, "Senator Heffernan's homophobic accusations against me in the Senate are false and absurd. If he has such accusations, he should approach the proper authorities, not slander a fellow citizen in Parliament. Insofar as he attempts to interfere in the performance of my duties as a judge, I reject the attempt utterly." The Australian Senate passed a motion ordering Heffernan to apologize for his remarks, but he's done nothing of the kind. The Committee on Parliamentary Privileges will consider whether the Senate itself should apologize to Kirby. Numerous politicians, legal groups, trade unions, and others, including most of the media, leap to criticize Heffernan and to defend Kirby as an outstanding jurist.
But Prime Minister John Howard was not among them. While declaring that Heffernan is standing down as the cabinet's parliamentary secretary for the duration, Howard is not firing him and referred to their close personal friendship, as well as defending Heffernan's right to speak freely in Parliament. Howard made only a lukewarm reference to the respect Kirby enjoys within his profession and suggested a new mechanism needs to be created to handle allegations against federal judges. He even indicated that it might not require a legal action to establish the proved misbehavior needed for Parliament to unseat a judge, saying, A proven misbehavior under the Constitution can take many forms and cover a lot of conduct it's not defined. And Howard's Attorney General Darrell Williams, who by tradition should be a key defender of the judiciary, has not stood up for Kirby, to the outrage of several leading law professors. Howard's ruling coalition has blocked every piece of gay-positive federal legislation during its tenure.
The situation has raised many broader issues regarding political interference with the judiciary, as well as the limits of parliamentary privilege. But an online poll suggests that Heffernan has, in one sense, correctly read public sentiment, as respondents have affirmed by about 2-1 that an openly gay judge should not preside over sex offense cases.
There have been two significant developments this week in Egypt's campaign of prosecutions against gay men. The so-called Dahmanur Five were convicted of debauchery in the Nile Delta misdemeanor court and sentenced to 3 years hard labor followed by 3 years probation. This is only one of a series of such cases, although homosexuality per se is not explicitly prohibited under Egyptian law. But this week, the Egyptian State Information Service, the national government's official information service, responded to a member of Britain's Rainbow Network with a lengthy statement condemning homosexuality and Western moves to protect gay and lesbian civil rights. Citing Islamic teachings that sex should be reserved for heterosexual marriage, the email said that homosexuality is socially detested and legally condemned in Egypt. The statement repeatedly described homosexuality as perverted and characterized it as a threat to the family and associated with physical and psychological illness.
Elsewhere in Africa, Zimbabwe's gays and lesbians resigned themselves to a fifth presidential term for one of the world's most vocal and virulent homophobes, Robert Mugabe, following elections this week. Foreign observers reported widespread violence, intimidation, and election fraud that have led some Western governments to drag their feet in recognizing the outcome. But the group GALS, Gays and Lesbians of Zimbabwe, took heart from the high voter turnout and what's generally viewed as the nation's best approximation of multi-party democracy since Mugabe's ZANU-PF party took over from British rule.
In the U.S., final rules for federal compensation for families of victims of the September 11th attacks effectively exclude most gay and lesbian domestic partners. Unless the victim explicitly named the partner in a will, the partner's standing to receive compensation is determined by the probate laws of their state of residence, and gay and lesbian partners are so recognized only in Vermont and Hawaii. The fund's administrator, Kenneth Feinberg, seemed quite dismissive of the problem in a TV appearance this week on Meet the Press, but softened somewhat in an interview with the gay and lesbian Washington Blade. While hoping that in most cases gay and lesbian survivors could work something out with victims' legally recognized families, he did say he might intervene to prevent an injustice, offering the hypothetical example of a gay victim whose blood relatives hadn't spoken to him for 15 years. There may be only 30 or 40 same-gender domestic partners who might seek the compensation, but more than $1 million is at stake in each case.
The Kansas State Supreme Court has negated a trans woman's marriage to a man in a high-profile inheritance case. Marshall Gardner died without a will, and his estranged son Joe challenged trans woman Janol Gardner's right as Marshall's wife to inherit his $2.5 million estate. This week's unanimous high court decision overturned a landmark state appeals court ruling. Whereas the Court of Appeal had undertaken an extensive review of scientific literature to reject what it called a rigid and simplistic approach to determining sex in favor of consideration of much more than judgments made at birth, the state Supreme Court went no further than Webster's Dictionary, whose definitions rely heavily on the ability to procreate. While admitting that Janol had, in the Chief Justice's words, traveled a long and difficult road, the state's high court found her to still be a male, and her marriage to violate Kansas's law recognizing marriage only between two parties of the opposite sex. The ruling per se cannot be appealed further, although Janol's attorneys are looking for some basis to take the case to the U.S. Supreme Court. Some expect the state Supreme Court's ruling to open a can of worms, not only in apparently legitimizing transsexuals' marriages to partners of their own self-identified gender, but also for possibly invalidating marriages of sterile heterosexuals with its reliance on reproductive ability to define sex.
And finally, it was quite a gay week in the world of entertainment. British singer Will Young rocketed to stardom as winner of the TV show Pop Idol, and with his first release, Evergreen, setting a UK first-week sales record, publicly identified himself as a gay man with a low-key statement in the tabloid News of the World. The announcement surprised no one and hasn't hurt his sales or fan base at all. It's remarkable only because no one of comparable status has come out so early in their career before. Meanwhile, as the awards season progresses towards Oscar night, the Directors Guild of America honored Open Gays Alan Ball and Todd Holland for their work on 6 Feet Under and Malcolm in the Middle, while the Screen Actors Guild gave Best Comedy Series Actor and Actress honors to Sean Hayes and Megan Mullally of NBC's gay-led sitcom Will and Grace. NBC then announced it's investing a whopping $300 million to renew Will and Grace for another 3 years. Also at the SAG Awards, openly gay British Oscar nominee Sir Ian McKellen took Best Supporting Actor film honors for his role as Gandalf in Lord of the Rings. As it happened, McKellen had been on stage opening the show just minutes before his victory was announced. So when he returned for his trophy, he joked, "I thought I'd had my turn."
That's News Wrap for the week ending March 16th, 2002, written by Cindy Friedman and recorded at the studios of KPFK Los Angeles.
Follow the news in your area. An informed community is a strong community. For This Way Out, I'm Cindy Friedman.
And I'm Christopher Gall.
You'll find out how playwright Alan Ball's early encounter with the Easter Bunny foreshadowed the success of his hit cable series about death later in the program. It's been an especially queer TV week, bracketed by March 9th's The Laramie Project on HBO and March 16th's The Matthew Shepard Story on NBC. In between, the UK's newly out pop idol Will Young was still at the BBC's Top of the Pops. Sir Ian McKellen hosted NBC's Saturday Night Live.
It's really, really fun and great to be here, where I feel really welcome, unlike the St. Patrick's Day Parade in New York City, where they don't exactly encourage openly gay men. They don't seem to mind the priests, though, do they?
And of course, the main and highly hyped TV event, popular daytime TV talk show diva and comedic actress Rosie O'Donnell's broadcasting the fact that she's a lesbian on ABC's Primetime Thursday, a special 2-hour edition subtitled Rosie's Story for the Sake of the Children, hosted by Diane Sawyer.
You know, a lot of the gay community has really given me a lot of crap in the last few years saying, you know, she's so out. And it's true, I am. I have lived my life very openly and very truthfully. When I was with a man, everyone knew who my partner was. And when I was with a woman, everyone knew who my partner was. There was never any secret or any hiding.
But you did wait.
I wanted to make sure until I was in a committed long-term relationship. I've been in one for about 4 years, a person I'm going to spend my life with. I wanted to make sure that I was ready to handle whatever it is that comes with this. And I wanted there to be a reason. And the Lofton case, this young boy, Bert, 10 years old, being threatened to take away from the only family he's known, that's a good reason for me.
The plight that fueled her decision to speak out centers on a 10-year-old foster child whose HIV status reverted from positive to negative. He'd been taken in as an infant by a gay couple, Roger Croteau and Stephen Lofton, who foster parented 6 such children, mostly from near death's door as babies. But now that the 10-year-old is HIV negative and a better candidate for adoption, the state of Florida wants to remove him from the only home he's ever known. Along with the states of Utah and Mississippi, Florida prohibits gays or lesbians from adopting children. With the support of the American Civil Liberties Union, Croteau and Lofton are suing the state of Florida for that right. Considerable screen time during the 2-hour telecast was given to the gay dads and their family.
I lost my identity years ago. I'm somebody's dad, and I just happen to be their dad.
So, 10 years from now, what's your dream?
That they're all out of the house.
Florida Representative Randy Ball defended his state's banning adoptions by gays or lesbians.
When you look at the rule is it is not that homosexual couples do not provide the kind of stable, wholesome environment that would justify the state having a law that allows them to adopt children.
So, to Bert, who doesn't want to leave this home, at the end of the day you say...
I would say we will not allow you to be adopted by the gentleman.
O'Donnell insisted that sexual orientation has nothing to do with quality parenting.
President Bush has said, "I believe children ought to be adopted in families with a woman and a man who are married."
Well, he's wrong. President Bush is wrong about that. He's really wrong. If he'd like, he and his wife were invited to come spend a weekend at my house with my children, and I'm sure his mind would change. You know, someone's sexuality does not define their essence. It's one of the many colors that make up the rainbow of your humanity. You should be rated on how well you are able to parent, not whether or not you're gay. I will pass any test that the Florida state has for me on my ability to parent.
And as for the future...
For those kids in foster care, I'll say this, I'll keep fighting for them. I'll keep fighting that each one of those 500,000 kids find a safe place to land. And I think as long as the place is safe, they don't care what the parents do in the bedroom. They don't. And the state of Florida shouldn't care either.
The ACLU has a website you might want to visit, www.lethimstay.com, from which you can join the over 80,000 people who emailed Florida Governor Jeb Bush within 24 hours of the broadcast to express an opinion on the adoption issue.
I'm Ellen DeGeneres, and you're listening to This Way Out, the Gay and Lesbian International News Magazine.
Undertakers are not the only people who are hooked on the HBO series 6 Feet Under. The show's first season ratings surpassed those of both the cable network's highly acclaimed The Sopranos and Sex and the City, and the outlook for the second season, which began this month, is promising. If you can say that about a series set in a funeral home. 6 Feet Under was created by American Beauty's Oscar-winning screenwriter Alan Ball, and some of his quirky characters are as gay as he is. Ball sat down for a chat with psychologist, actor, and activist Charlie Lang.
Alan, how do you account for the tremendous audience appeal of 6 Feet Under?
Well, I think basically it's that there is something in the show for everyone. The characters cover such a wide range of ground that there's something that everybody can relate to. Also, I think it's just unusual for a show to really kind of confront mortality and spirituality in sort of just a practical way, which is one of the reasons I was drawn to the project, just the notion of people who we pay to face death for us, what that must do to their lives. I just found that arena very curious, and I think, you know, as a society, we tend to be in a little bit of denial about death. We want to sweep it under the carpet. The truth is, it's part of life. And then I think, you know, out of all the characters in the show, everybody can find one character that has something in common with them.
You mentioned mortality and spirituality, and I'm almost wanting to add sexuality to that as well. I mean, the sexuality and the way it's being explored in the characters is certainly something we're not used to seeing on television.
Certainly not on network television,
And exploring the character's sexuality, I'm thinking particularly of the mother in the show, played by Franny Conroy, and her gay son, David. Was this something that you were invited to do, or have you had to fight for the sort of texture that you're able to bring to these characters in terms of their sexuality?
Oh, I've never had to fight for it. In fact, the most common note that I get from HBO is, can you make it more complicated? Which is almost diametrically opposed to the common notes that I got from the networks, which were, can you make everybody nicer? And can you articulate the subtext? Can you have somebody say what's actually going on in the scene? And of course, you know, I believe the drama is conflict and subtext. So you remove those two things, and what do you have? You have like filler between commercials, basically.
I'm thinking about Ruth, this woman, middle-aged, little past middle-aged perhaps, having the freedom to explore her sexuality the way she does in the show. I'm imagining that it might be somewhat liberating to be able to write a character like that. I mean, it's just so not seen.
Yeah, it's really wonderful to write that character because usually we're used to seeing in movies or on television, if a woman is sexually active or even sexually assertive past a certain age, then she's sort of branded as kind of a, you know, Alexis Carrington jumps to mind. She's sort of got this evil trollop edge to her. And I still think that we really suffer from the Madonna whore polarities in the depiction of women and their sexuality in mainstream entertainment. And what I love about Ruth is that she is a woman in her 50s and she is sexual and she's not really ashamed of it. I mean, well, she's not ashamed of it at all. On mainstream network television, a woman hits a certain age, and unless she turns into like a power-hungry corporate femme fatale, sex is no longer a part of her life. She's kind of moved beyond that.
And while Ruth is going through this sort of fascinating parallel story is the story of her son, David, mm-hmm. who has this tremendous arc in his story of coming out. And it's so textured in terms of his own self-exploration and the way he communicates his mm-hmm. own struggles. You know, he's angry at himself. He's angry at others. Sometimes it's misplaced anger. Is there a lot of Alan Ball in that character?
Oh, sure. I mean, I went through a very similar journey earlier in my life because I think one of the dilemmas that confronts gay men is there's a little bit of a Madonna whore complex going on there as well. I mean, you're either like the good guy who finds a relationship and everything is perfect and wonderful and storybook, you know, happily ever after, or you're like this drug-swilling party boy who goes to all the circuit parties and just has sex around the clock. And I think the reality of learning to incorporate your sexuality into your life in sort of an integrated and healthy way is very much somewhere in between those two. And of course, David, you know, also what complicates it for him is he's very religious. He was an altar boy, and he's somebody for whom belonging to a traditional structure is very important. And I'm very fascinated about what's happening in the world of religion politically and the ways that religions are really dragging their feet on including gays and lesbians in the congregations and just saying, you know what, this is just, it's not a big deal. Because it seems to me what's going on is like very bureaucratic and kind of ludicrous, because I look at those kinds of things and I think a council of a bunch of ministers in some Midwestern state, I'm sorry, you just don't have the power to keep me separate from God. You don't. So you can publish as many decrees and say as much as you want to about this or that, but you don't have that power. I wanted to get into a little exploration of gays and religion and spirituality, and David sort of a little doorway into that. But I think one of the things that I had to struggle with, because I grew up going to church and basically buying into the whole propaganda that if I was gay, that kept me out of heaven, is that what that does to you is then you think, well, obviously I'm a sinner, so yes, I have to like go into the excesses of, you know, just promiscuous sexuality and drugs and sort of escape that way, because that's all there is for me, because I obviously can't belong to a church and still be a gay man, you know, which of course more and more and more people are doing, you know, so I think we're seeing a real change in that.
So what David's looking for and what you're having the opportunity to explore is the alternative story mm-hmm. of being able to have both a healthy sexuality and a connection up to God.
Yeah, I think David's biggest enemy in the first season, at least, is himself, because he's the one who is doing the most harsh judging of himself and his own behavior. That's not to say that there aren't forces in society that certainly don't feed that. But ultimately, I think the coming out process is really coming out to yourself and owning that and integrating that into your life. Because I think as long as people remain in the closet and they keep their sexuality a secret, there's a certain schism going on. It's hard to live a fully authentic life when that schism is there. You know, I'm not saying everybody should come out, because I do believe it's a personal choice. But I just know that for me, coming out was probably the single greatest step towards mental health that I ever took.
You're listening to Alan Ball, creator of the HBO series 6 Feet Under, in conversation with Charlie Lang on This Way Out, the international gay and lesbian radio magazine.
When did you come out?
Officially?
Yeah, how do we determine that? Yeah.
I told my mom I was gay when I was 33. I so bought the bill of goods that you can't be happy if you're a gay man that I just was fiercely trying to be straight for so many years. And I was in college, you know, I would have a little too much to drink and some also, quote, straight, unquote, guy in the theater department, you know, at a party. We would end up like, you know, having some clumsy groping in some drunken state. And I would feel incredibly guilty about that. And I was also conveniently bisexual for many years. I would date women. And then I would always get a little drunk, or I would accompany my gay friends to the gay bar to prove how liberal I was. And then I would drink a little too much and, you know, go home with some Mennonite plumber. And, you know, finally I just woke up and I went, who are you kidding?
What woke you up?
I refer to this as my adventures in Middle Earth. I went with a friend of mine to this place in Florida called Cedar Key, which is this remote little island that is sort of trapped in time. And we met a bunch of old hippies. And somebody said, hey, would you guys like to drop acid? And I had never done that before in my life. And I thought, yeah, that sounds good. So we did, and then my friend disappeared, and then the acid kicked in when I was with a group of total strangers in a place I've never been before, which is not something I would recommend anybody do. Mm. And this one woman was incredibly nice to me and sort of realized I was having a bad trip, as it were. And sort of in my hallucinatory state, I imagined that she was my soulmate, and we had been through many, many lifetimes together, and I sort of fell madly in love with her and wanted to spend the rest of my life with her and be a writer. Of course, I told her all this in my altered state of consciousness. So the next weekend, I went back to pursue this relationship with her, and there was this guy with her, and he was like this big biker. And I was like, okay, well, all right, I guess let me readjust my picture of what was going to happen this weekend. And then I ended up sleeping with him. I don't know why. There was no LSD involved that time. But something just very clearly inside me spoke to me and said, you know what, this is really who you are. And this is, for whatever reason, genetic, upbringing, choice, whatever, this is so much more satisfying on not just a sexual level, on like a deeper, fundamental, who you are, soul kind of level. And that's when I just went, okay, all right, I'm not going to fight it anymore, you know.
You were a playwright before you moved to L.A. from New York.
Mm-hmm.
What was
before I sold my soul to the devil?
I'm glad you said that and not me. What was the very first thing you ever wrote?
I wrote a play when I was 6 years old about the Easter Bunny and about these two sisters who accidentally discovered where he lived. And they had this information about him, and I think they were looking for ways to exploit that information. And then it all ended in a big egg fight where people threw eggs at each other.
And you were 6 years old.
I was 6 years old.
And this was performed.
Yes, we put it on for the PTA, and I played the Easter Bunny. And I had a little pair of horn-rimmed glasses with big construction paper rabbit ears pasted to them.
Would you say that there are themes from your earlier work as a six-year-old playwright that still resonate with your work today?
Well, certainly you can look at that play and see a central character who is somewhat unusual and different, who is put in the precarious position of possibly having his secret life discovered.
Mm-hmm.
So I guess, yeah, that's similar to David's dilemma in 6 Feet Under.
That was 6 Feet Under creator Alan Ball in conversation with Charlie Lang. You can dig deeper into the series by checking out the show's official HBO.com website. Thanks for choosing This Way Out, the International Lesbian and Gay Radio Magazine. This week, Cindy Friedman, Christopher Gall, Graham Underhill, Brian Nunes, Jason Lynn, Chris Ambidge, Rex Walkner, and Charlie Lang contributed program material. Thanks also to Chris Allen. Kim Wilson composed and performed our theme music. Remember, you can listen to This Way Out anytime online, exclusively on Planet Out. Just point your browser to www.planetout.com and click first on Multimedia, then on Radio. Some This Way Out operating expenses are funded by direct charitable donations from our listeners around the world. To learn how you can help keep This Way Out on the air, please visit our website at thiswayout.org, email us at tworadio@aol.com, or write to us at Post Office Box 38327, Los Angeles, California, 90038, USA. For Associate Producer Lucy Chappell and everyone at This Way Out, I'm Greg Gordon. Thanks for listening on C101 Hamilton, Ontario, WMPG Gorham, Maine, KAOS Olympia, Washington, and more than 125 other stations around the world, including this community radio station. Please stay tuned.